Good morning. How's everyone doing? It's a lovely morning out there. I love these first cool days of fall. This morning, I'd like to talk about the Mississippi River. I'm going to talk about some of my favorite places on the river, and I'm going to use a kind of extended metaphor. Actually, it's an extended simile, but let's not get technical. An extended metaphor or a simile can be a little dicey because it can get overextended and a little strained. And if we try too hard to say that one thing is like another thing, we can get a little attached to the mental construction that we've come up with. And then we only see the mental construction and we miss the thing itself. Once when I was driving with my family from Omaha to Michigan, we camped on the Mississippi River at Buffalo, Iowa, which is just a little bit downriver from Davenport. And the thing I remember from that night of camping on the river is the sand. The river had a really big, really sandy bank there. It wasn't quite the nice clean sand that we tend to see at lakes up here in Minnesota. River sand usually has some dirt in it, so it's a little bit coarse, but it has its own kind of beauty. And we were walking on the sand. This is when my son was really little, and we were delighted to come to this place where someone had made a sand sculpture. And it was kind of it looked like a sea monster, or I suppose it was a river monster. And it had a great mouth and many teeth made from little bits of driftwood. And it was a really lighthearted thing. And it was fascinating, and it was beautiful, and I wondered who left it there. Sand sculptures are great because they're necessarily impermanent, like Tibetan sand paintings. And it's a good Buddhist practice, I think, to attempt to make something beautiful and let it be for a while, and then to completely let it go. So that's how I want this extended simile about the river to be. We'll consider it for a while, and hopefully it will help us to see something, and then we'll let it go. It's just a construction. It's empty. And I'm not going to keep you in suspense about the nature of this simile. I'll tell you now what the river stands for purposes of this talk. The river has no clear beginning and no clear end, and it is always changing. It's not really a thing. It's not really an identifiable individual thing at all. It's a process interrelated to many other processes. But we choose to call it a thing rather than calling it a process. And if we consider this about the river, maybe we can consider this about ourselves. We can consider that we human beings have no clear beginning and no clear end, and we're always changing. And that has significance as to how we live in the world. And I'll talk more about that later. So let's begin at the beginning. The river, as most Minnesotans know, starts at Lake Itasca in Itasca State Park. How many people have been there? Quite a few people. Not as many as I might have thought, though. Well, this is one of my favorite places. The park, Itasca Park, is really large and it's wild, and it contains lots of old growth red pines, lots of old growth white pines. And it was also the first place where I ever saw the Mississippi River. When I was maybe 10 or 11 or 12, my dad, who almost never took us anywhere, took us to Itasca State Park from our farm, which was in the Red River Valley of North Dakota. And our farm was on this flat, bare place. And that has its own sort of beauty, but I had never seen a great forest. I hadn't seen that many trees, actually. And when we got to Itasca and I saw those great trees, I was so overwhelmed that I cried. It was so beautiful. That was in a place called Preacher's Grove, which at the time did not seem significant to me. Starting probably about 8 years ago, my wife Kathy and I have gone to Itasca probably at least once a year. And we bike there in the summer. We had this incredible day of biking there, which was so beautiful. We came upon an old historical town that we didn't know was there with a working sawmill. And this guy was there and he gave us this tour. and we visited a lot of beautiful places. We go cross-country skiing there in the winter, and we'll always stay in a cabin there. And we always go to what is said to be the source of the Mississippi River. And the river flows out of the northernmost point of the lake, and it's maybe 15 feet across or so, and you can wade across. And there's a sign there on a carved tree trunk, and it's the same sign that I read there 50 years ago when I first went there. And it says, "Here, 1,475 feet above the ocean, the mighty Mississippi begins to flow its winding way 2,552 miles to the Gulf of Mexico." So there's this monument there to the beginning of the river. But is that really the beginning? It's traditionally accepted as the beginning. But do you know what? There are several small streams that feed Lake Itasca. Why don't we choose the beginning of one of those small streams as the beginning of the river? Or why don't we say it has multiple beginnings? And why don't we recognize that each of those small streams, if they're not spring-fed, may have sources that change over time? During a great rainstorm, it may be a long stream, and during a dry period, it may be a short stream. So the true source of the river actually fluctuates, and we really can't designate it. We could even argue that the Mississippi begins in the clouds, or it begins in the rain, in these tiny rivulets, maybe as big as a drinking straw, that enter these tiny streams. Maybe it's one of those. So actually, this designation about the beginning of the river is somewhat arbitrary, and it has to be. And it's the same with us. We want to designate the beginning of the river with precision, and we want to designate the beginning of our lives with precision. And usually we talk about when we were born. That was the beginning. But we could talk about the moment we were conceived. We could talk about when we were just a gleam in our daddy's eye, as the expression goes. All things are interrelated through time, and a popular Buddhist koan asks, "What did your face look like before your parents were born?" Open it up. You had no beginning. Nothing you can pinpoint. You came together gradually, and you'll come apart gradually. So, the Mississippi River leaves Itasca, and it enters various lakes, and it comes out of them again. Another favorite place of ours is Crow Wing State Park near Brainerd, where the Crow Wing River, which is kind of hard to say, the Crow Wing River joins the Mississippi. And we go there to ski, and there's usually no one there, and it's really quiet. And it's one of our favorite places. There's a great indentation there you can see on the shore of the Mississippi. That's where ox carts crossed the river years ago when they were bringing goods from the Red River Valley and from Winnipeg down to the Twin Cities. And of course, the place where Kathy and I experience the river most, and most of us do, is right here in the Twin Cities. Here at Zen Center, I think we're about 3 miles from the river. It's right up that way. And you could probably say that we're right next to the river. And you could probably say that we can see it from this room. Because this lake out here, which, by the way, was formerly known only as Lake Calhoun, and is now known by its restored Dakota name, and does anyone know how to pronounce this? It looks to me like Made Maka Ska. So that's the Dakota name, which is restored, which is wonderful. Subject for another talk, probably. Lake Calhoun drains into Lake Harriet. You can see the spot right down here. And that drains into Minnehaha Creek, which drains into the Mississippi. So we're basically next to a tributary of the river. And Cedar Lake drains into this lake here. So when we talk about a river, do we include the tributaries? Or are those separate rivers? Is the river just the river, or is it the watershed of the river? That decision, again, is somewhat arbitrary. And the same with us. Are we just our individual selves, or are we the people around us? Are we the people who flow into us? Are we our parents and our grandparents and other members of the Sangha? So it's strange what people get excited about, and I get excited about ancient glacial rivers and lakes. And I know that's kind of an oddball thing to be interested in. But I think I know why I'm so fascinated this. I've lived all my life except for 1 year here in the Midwest, and I've traveled a lot around the Midwest, and I'm always watching the land, and I always notice when I go from maybe one watershed to another. And I always wonder how the land came to be that way. And I'm fascinated by glacial features like kettles and drumlins. I'm fascinated to see how the hills here were smoothed out by the last glacier. But if you go to southeast Minnesota, the last glacier did not reach that far. And it's really a different kind of country down where Hopioji is. It's really wild down there. And I'm fascinated about how the place where I grew up, which is now known as the Red River Valley, the reason it's incredibly flat is because it was the bed of glacial Lake Agassiz, which was a lake that was larger than all of the Great Lakes put together, and I think was larger than any freshwater lake existing on Earth at this time. So I've been looking into geology. At one time, around 11,000 years ago, right about where downtown St. Paul is now, which is about 2 miles from my house, there was a waterfall, which was truly incredibly massive. It was about a half mile wide and 175 feet tall. Can you imagine? That is larger than Niagara Falls is now. And just imagine that. This waterfall, it's now called River Warren Falls. And this massive amount of water came from glacial River Warren, which drained Lake Agassiz down through what is now the Minnesota River Valley. And at that time, glacial River Warren was actually much larger than the Mississippi. So this waterfall appeared about 11,000 years ago. And what happened to the waterfall? Well, here's what happened. Above the falls, there was this hard layer of limestone that the water flowed on. And then it went over the falls. And when the water goes over the falls, it eats away at the base because there's softer rock underneath the limestone. So it eats away at the base, and so there creates an overhang of the hard limestone, and the hard limestone breaks off. So every time it breaks off, the waterfall recedes a little bit. It moves up the river. And it did that at a rate of probably several feet per year. So the waterfall was a process. It never stayed in one place. And it moved upstream gradually over the period of a few thousand years, all the way to Minneapolis in time, to St. Anthony Falls, which is still there today, but you can't see it because it's underwater, because there's a dam there. That's the only falls existing on the Mississippi now. So St. Anthony Falls is a vestige of that. And another vestige of this massive falls in St. Paul is Minnehaha Falls, because as it receded, it also receded up its tributary, Minnehaha Creek. So 11,000 years is just a blink of an eye in geological time. But it's a log, log time when you think about human history. It's hundreds of generations, I think. And we're connected to that time through our ability to see these features in the landscape. That 11,000 years seems incredibly long, and yet at the same time, it seems present with us today because we can see it in miniature at Minnehaha Falls. And I think this tells us something else about the river. I've already suggested that the nameable river, the definable river, is an artificial construction because it really has no beginning. And because it's inseparable from so many other things, including its tributaries and even the rain and the clouds. Well, not only that, but the river also cannot be said to exist independently of its past and future. Anything we call the river today is just a snapshot in time. It's a continuously changing process. And in the same way, we humans are connected with the past and the future. We can think of ourselves as individuals having finite lifespans, but if we think of ourselves as part of the human race, we are just part of a process going back thousands and millions of years, and perhaps into the future just as long. So if we go down the river some more, we come to Red Wing, where Kathy and I have actually gotten to spend some time on the river because Kathy's brother and his wife have a cabin there, and they take us up to the cabin in a little boat. They took us through a lock one time, which was really cool. And this cabin is this beautiful place of sand and driftwood and enormous cottonwood trees. And it's just the most pleasant place to hang out and build a little fire in the fall. And you sit there and you watch the leaves falling and you watch the river flowing by. And if you go down a little further, you come to Winona. When I was younger, I built grain elevators for a while. I did construction work, and I would travel around to do this. And in Winona, I worked on a very large grain elevator that was near the river, and I camped by the river, and I canoed in the backwaters there. And a little past Winona is one of our favorite places, Trempealeau, Wisconsin. Anybody here been to Trempealeau? Yeah, a few people. It's this beautiful little town, this tiny town, which is right on the river, and it seems like everybody there is just really nice. And there's this place called the Trempealeau Hotel, which is an old hotel, and it's one of the coolest places I ever stayed. But the really astonishing thing about Trempealeau is a geological feature. And I first saw this one time when I was driving at night north on the Minnesota side. I was driving next to the bluffs. They were towering above me. I think it must have been a moonlit night because I could see the bluffs. And the bluffs in Wisconsin were far, far away. I don't think I could see them. But all of a sudden, I come to this place where it appears that there are these massive bluffs right in the middle of the river, standing entirely alone. And I was just astonished at this. And I later found out the explanation for this, which involved, I think, the changing course of the river, that the river went behind, I won't go into it, because I barely remember it. But later, I went to the Wisconsin side, and I visited these bluffs, and I saw they weren't exactly in the middle of the river. They were actually close to the Wisconsin side, but one of them, which is known as Trempealeau Mountain, is completely surrounded by water. It's 420 feet high, and it's conical in shape, and it's just magnificent. And that is part of Perot State Park. And we've hiked on the bluffs near that mountain in both summer and winter, and we've biked there. And we've taken a canoe out to the base of Trempealeau Mountain. And it's a beautiful place to see. But we'll probably never climb it because I think there are no paths. And also, Trempealeau Mountain is famous for its rattlesnakes. It's also a place that is sacred to Native Americans, as are many, many places on the river. And there are stories that there are flying rattlesnakes there. Now, I don't know. I'm not going to find out. So, further down the river, on the Minnesota-Iowa border, is a town called New Albon, Iowa. And that's just a few miles from Hokyoji, which is a monastery founded by Dainin Katagiri, who founded this Zen Center. And that's a place that people from Zen Center have been going to for close to 40 years now. It's a place to go for retreats, and some people live there. And it's an incredibly, incredibly beautiful place in those wild, unglaciated hills down there in southeastern Minnesota, far from civilization. If you stay there at night, you will probably hear some coyotes. You will most likely hear no sounds of civilization at all, except for a very occasional sound of car wheels on the gravel road, and maybe a distant train whistle from the tracks, which are right next to the river in New Albon, a few miles away. So it's a place where you have a great sense of quiet, and I think a sense of your own smallness, because you're among these really large hills. By the way, Susan Nelson and I will be leading a 5-day retreat there starting September 23rd, which is pretty soon, but you can still sign up for a 2-day or 5-day option. And the best way to drive there, not the quickest way, but the best way, is just to follow the river all the way down. And it is a beautiful drive. And it gets more and more rural, and your head gets more and more quiet. So, further south, in Iowa, is McGregor, where I built another grain elevator. This one was right next to the river. It was the kind of elevator where they fill barges directly from the elevator. And there was a beautiful view as it was going up, and I stayed with some friends there in a lovely place called Whippoorwill Hollow. And south of that is Buffalo. with those vast, sandy, dirty beaches. And I like to think about that sand, and when I do, I think of the Diamond Sutra, which I first read years ago. It's been 20 years since I read the Diamond Sutra. And the one part that has stuck with me, the one image that has stuck with me for 20 years, was the part about the sands of the Ganges. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha uses the sands of the Ganges as a way of opening up Subhuti's mind to the infinite, I think. And I would just like to read a little excerpt of that. Subhuti, what do you think concerning the sand grains of the Ganges? Has the Buddha taught about them? Yes, world-honored one, the Tathagata has taught concerning these grains. Well, Subhuti, if there were as many Ganges rivers as the sand grains of the Ganges, and there was a Buddha land for each sand grain in all those Ganges rivers, would those Buddha lands be many? Many indeed, world-honored one. Subhuti, however many living beings there are in all those Buddha lands, though they have manifold modes of mind, the Tathagata understands them all. Wherefore? Because the Tathagata teaches that all these are not mind, they are merely called mind. Subhuti, it is impossible to retain past mind, impossible to hold on to present mind, and impossible to grasp future mind. Now, I would not want to have to explicate that, but I'm quoted here simply because it uses that technique of opening the mind to the infinite. Think of a Mississippi River existing for every grain of sand in the Mississippi River. And think of another river existing for every grain of sand in each of those rivers, and on and on. So the river has no beginning, it can't be defined, it's an arbitrary construct, it goes back into time and forward into the future, and it's inseparable from other things. And if we open our minds further by thinking of the seemingly infinite number of grains of sand on the banks of the river along its 2,552-mile course, or if we think of the seemingly infinite number of drops of water in the river and its tributaries, and we multiply these, both getting smaller and getting larger, we multiply these by thinking of the components of each grain of sand and each drop of water, and we can see that there is something too vast here for us to comprehend with our limited human minds. And we can go the other way and think of the entire watershed, the entire continent, the entire planet, and galaxies, and the really large systems of which galaxies are only a tiny part. The river, like our own bodies, is made up of infinitely smaller and smaller components and is part of infinitely larger and larger systems. It's good to think about this. We are so very small, and we are so very large somehow. So down the river from Buffalo is a place I'll bet no one here has been to called Oquaka, Illinois. Anyone? Okay. That is a tiny town across the river from Burlington and a little north. And that's the place where I built my first grain elevator in 1979. And I will never forget that place because that was a wild adventure. I hitchhiked down there alone and I took up this work I had never done before. I think I knew one person on the job site. And there was quite a crew of interesting people, quite a wild bunch. And we would work the night shift, 12 hours from 7 to 7, and we would gather at the Blue Goose Tavern at 7 a.m. And one night on the elevator, we had a plague of mayflies. They were everywhere. You couldn't touch anything without touching a mayfly, and that plague lasted one day. Of course, it wasn't really a plague. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. They were so ephemeral. And they only lived that one day. And one night, as we were climbing the stairs, it's called the Safeway. It's like a metal scaffolding. You climb up the elevator, which has been glowing now for 8 days. The skies got incredibly dark and were full of movement. And it looked like a really bad storm. And the river, I swear, turned black. I've never seen the Mississippi River black before. And it looked so dangerous. But we all went up because we had agreed to do this thing. And when you do slip form construction, you can't stop. It's a continuous pour all the way up. And it turned out okay. We just got a little wet. That was all. No one got hurt. No one got blown off. But I'll never forget the drama of that. I'll never forget the beauty of that. So during that first slip, you call it a slip, it was 8 days, and it was kind of like doing my first long meditation retreat in that it was one of the hardest things I ever did. It was one of the best things I ever did. And when I finished, I felt so strong. And when I finished, I was hooked. I'm going to keep doing this, I said. So that was a long time ago. I was a different person then. I may look the same in many ways, but that Ted has been gradually replaced bit by bit, physically replaced with new matter. Emotionally, I'm quite different, quite a lot more grown up, deeper practice now, I would say. I'm a process, that's all. So I've been south of Oquaka, down as far as St. Louis, where the river is really wide, and that's it. That's as far as I've gone. I have dreams of going further. I've always wanted to drive down the river all the way, following it all the way past Memphis and New Orleans, and I've looked at the maps. You can drive to a place called Venice on Louisiana State Highway 23, and it looks like it's a few miles from the end of the river. But of course, you can't really say where the river ends. For one thing, it's a delta. It breaks into a number of channels. It's like the river saying that a few tiny streams came together in Lake Itasca to form it, and it's going to break into multiple big streams together at the end. It refuses to be one thing. It's going to come together for a while, and then it's going to dissipate. And also, where is the interface between the river and the ocean? Where does the river end and the ocean begin? We have fresh water flowing out into the sea. We have the salt water penetrating the channel. Who can say where one ends and the other begins? And there's something else about the end. There's an influence of the Mississippi River that reaches far into the Gulf of Mexico, and that is something called the dead zone. This is an area where many kinds of ocean life cannot live because there's not enough oxygen. And as I understand it, I'm no expert, it's the result of fertilizer and pesticides and animal waste flowing into the river from farms. And most of this comes from farms in Illinois, Iowa, Ohio, and Minnesota, where drainage tiles are used extensively. So we cause it. This dead zone is about the size of the state of New Jersey. So I ask, is the dead zone the river or is it the ocean? And if I can stretch my simile just a little bit further, maybe near the breaking point here, I think that allowing pollutants to go into the river is, in a very direct way, creating bad karma. It has a result. And the results are felt very, very far away from the actions that produce them. And similarly, we as human beings, we create karma in our lifetimes. The karma we create will continue after we're gone. We each are having so many effects in this world through our actions, some good, some bad. And I ask, can we clearly define a precise end to our lives when the effects of our karma continue? The human life cannot be separated from past and present, from the tiny worlds within or the great worlds without. The human life is a process, and we can only hope to define it by taking a snapshot in both time and space. And this is not merely philosophical, I think. This is something we can really come to know. This is experiential. We can come to know this by meditating. Buddhists are not the only people who can come to know this. But Buddhism is set up to help you come to know this. And now for the great question. Why would I tell you all of this? If you've heard my talks before, you've probably heard me say these things. You've heard other teachers say these things here. The separate self is an illusion. You don't really exist. Nothing is permanent. Nothing is real. And I think a rational response when you hear that type of thing is to say, hey, I'm going to go find some other religion. So some religion where there's something unchanging that I can hold on to, at least during my life? Can I at least be real while I'm living? You know, okay, afterwards maybe no. But, so why do I say this? Well, first, because I think it's true. Second, I think, and this might surprise you, but I think it's a source of great comfort to know that you're not real. All humans are tested, and all humans have to go through things that seem at times almost unbearable. We need to face the prospect that life is not permanent, not our own life, and not the lives of those whom we love, and we're all going to lose people. And it can be a great comfort to know that the separate self is an illusion. Because the other side of that is that if we're not separate from things, we are together with things. The thing that we perceive as separate may die, but the togetherness of all things cannot die. It is, by definition, a continuous process. And we can try and try and capture and define and cherish and keep an unchanging thing called the river or called our life, or we can accept that it's a process and surrender to that. And there's a freedom in that. We're not fighting reality. Everything changes. There's nothing to hang on to here. This is good. This is good. We can be really open, and we can see the past and present and the lack of a clear beginning and all of this. And we can know that this interconnectedness, this thusness, this how things are, is going to continue. And the people we've lost, their karma continues. The thusness of which they were a part continues. In a sense, we haven't lost them at all. I had a dream recently. My grandson Oscar is almost 11 months old now, and I had a beautiful dream about him. I was in a room with my son Dylan and his wife Corey and Oscar, and I think they were holding Oscar together. And I became aware that there were two other people there, these two really old people, and I saw that it was my grandfather and grandmother, my grandpa and grandma Carpenter. And in my dream, I thought, that cannot be right, because they couldn't be alive at the same time as Oscar. That was too long ago. And waking up, I remembered the dream, and I realized, yeah, my grandparents were Oscar's great-great-grandparents, and they never could have met him. And yet, there they were in the dream. And I don't think that was a random dream. I think that dream was reminding me that they really are here, that they really are a part of this. They created my mom, who created me, who created Dylan, who created Oscar. And they made me, to a very large extent, who I am. They taught me how to garden. They taught me joy and equanimity and hard work. And those things filter down through the generations. And they're in Dylan. You should see Dylan talk about joy. I think being a dad is the only thing he ever wanted. So that's why I keep saying this, that you don't exist, because it's a source of joy. That's why. There is thusness, there is interconnectedness of time and space. And here I may seem to go against everything I've said so far, but things at the same time are separate. There is Oscar. He's an individual. There is that too. There is Ted, the individual Ted. Because things have two aspects. There is thusness and the continuity through the generations, which is undifferentiated. And there is separateness and the self and Oscar, which are differentiated. And both of these things are true at the same time, even though they're contradictory. And that is Zen. That is Zen. And the only reason I say you do not exist is because that's the part that is perhaps not so familiar to you. If you really got that, that you do not exist, I would be saying, but you do exist. You do. It's both of these things that you have to know. And 2 weeks ago, in my talk on respect for things, I briefly mentioned Genjo Koan. And this is a Japanese term which is very deep and rich, and it has to do with existing wholeheartedly in the day-to-day world, in which, this is a quote, elegant, boundaryless suchness is abundantly evident in each and every instant of life. Elegant, boundaryless suchness is abundantly evident in each and every instant in life. Shohaku Okamura, in his book on the Genjo Koan, talks about how in practice, in our Zen practice, we learn to bring these two things together. When I bow to you, if I'm the Doshi and you're coming out of the Zendo in the morning after meditation, and we bow to each other, we are forms in this world. We exist separately in this world, and I am showing my respect for you. But we're also aware that everything is interconnected, and we're not just bowing to each other, we're bowing to all creatures. I'm bowing to the you that's in me, and you're bowing to the me that's in you, and we're bowing to everything. It all comes together. So it's not that you don't exist, it's that you exist and you don't exist. The things of this life are real and are not real and are to be enjoyed. And you know what? The things of this life are beautiful. They are so beautiful. Especially when we see both sides. Those trees in Itasca that made me cry as a child, that was one of the greatest days of my life. Going with Kathy on a winter's day at Crow Wing in complete silence, no one around, the snow is falling, and we're skiing next to the river. I could never forget the feeling of that day because it was so beautiful. And every day I go to work, I get to drive over the I-35 bridge, and I look down to the right at that sacred point where the Mississippi and the Minnesota rivers come together, and I look for barges, and it makes me happy every single day, and I look off to my left, and I imagine that great waterfall over there, and I can almost hear it, and I wonder how many miles away could you hear that waterfall? Maybe 20? I don't know. And down at the cabin, hearing the sounds of the wind in the cottonwoods, and being down at Hokyoji, and seeing the spider webs glistening with dew early in the morning when the sun has just come up, and Dokai cutting the grass and the smell of the freshly cut grass. And that wild night when I climbed up the scaffold to the elevator and the river turned black, and Trempealeau Mountain, that beautiful sacred mountain, and the burial mounds all up and down the river marking sacred spaces and past generations. These things are beautiful. And so, if you accept my premise that you're like the river, and that like the river, you really are not real, and that like the river, you really are real, what do you do? What do you do with your life? You flow. That's all you do. You just flow. So, thank you. So, we have a few minutes here. Does anyone have a comment or a question, perhaps? Yes.
Well, I like to think we all start from the Mississippi River here with our breath, because it bleeds in and out.
Absolutely. That should be in Wikipedia at the place where the Mississippi starts. Absolutely. Thanks. Yes, Gary.
Yeah. Just a matter of synchronicity here. I started reading Bill Bryson's A Short History of Everything yesterday. For anybody here that has it, go home. First page of the first chapter begins something like the kind of congratulations for being here, for you to be here. It means that not one single one of your ancestors died in 3 billion years. Not one of those killed or anything else until they passed on a DNA message that became you.
Uh-huh.
You are the first and only one like you in 3 billion years, and you are an event that's never happened again and has never happened before. I guess. So just, for those of you who like metaphors, it's quite a gripping first page.
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you. Yes, Benny.
So this is an even older geological feature here that predates the ice ages.
Mm-hmm.
You follow up Sweet Hollow, up Gervais and Keller and White Bear Lake. That's where the Mississippi used to flow.
Really?
It might not have been called the Mississippi. I don't know what they call it, but that was before the ice age.
Wow.
And Glacier smoothed that out. It didn't flatten it. You know, glaciers still went up and down hills, and so it just kind of smoothed all that out. And then when the glaciers melted, it came up in a different place.
The
warm.
But you can see some vestige of where the river used to be.
Sweet Hollow is the most obvious part of it.
Uh-huh.
The lake chain goes up that way.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Stuff is just fascinating. St. Croix River drained another lake, which covered, I think, really all of the Great Lakes now. Uh-huh. And it was truly massive. I think the river filled that entire valley at one time. Yeah. So in my next life, I want to go around looking for these things and mapping them. And I wonder, how do they figure this out? I mean, exactly, how the waterfall moved and everything. They know how to read the clues.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool.
Every rock tells a story.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay, Andrea.
Just along the same lines, the Mississippi used to outflow somewhere completely different from New Orleans. It used to go a totally different path, and the Army Corps of Engineers has devoted many of the last 70 years to keeping it in the New Orleans path, because it wants to go back to its original path. And so there's a book about it by John McPhee where he talks about the Herculean efforts that they're going to continue, keep the river flowing where it is now, because that's convenient for us economically, and the infrastructure is all built up around it. And
yeah.
There's some kind of metaphor in that as well.
That is. Yeah. And in fact, I had to cut a lot out of this talk because it could have been hours long. And I had some stuff in there about the Army Corps of Engineers and about the locks and dams and how they're building some islands down near, I think, near La Crosse for habitat, because they've destroyed so much habitat. I don't mean to be too judgmental about this, because I'm no expert and there are a lot of complicated things here. There's flood control and all kinds of stuff. But there is, this attempted taming of the river, and I think, what's the metaphor in that?
Attempting to tame
our minds, Yes. Okay, but we won't go there. All right. Well, thanks, everyone. I think we can go to the announcements now, Jim.
Great. Well, to make it-